Good evening, and firstly, I want to thank the curators for putting together such a fantastic program. I'm in particular humbled by the fact that I'm in the company of a number of my heroes, people who I've read and been inspired by for many years. In many ways, the topic for my talk today arose out of a temporal coincidence that was just way too uncanny to ignore. Sometimes we choose our topics, other times our topics choose us, but today the date of this conference has chosen mine. Exactly 70 years ago, to this date, which is the 23rd of March, on 23rd March 1947, before India had obtained full independence, an event was organized in Delhi, the Asian Relations Conference. And it's to this event that I want to turn my attention to look both at its failures, but also its promises, and what, in a way, kind of future potential it still holds for us. But before I move back 70 years, let me move back to a couple of weeks ago. On the 3rd of February 2017, a renowned feminist academic and political scientist, Nivedita Menon, was in Jodhpur University to speak at a conference on history and national identity, in which she, amongst other things, raised troubling questions about India's peripheries, Kashmir and the Northeast, questioning the naturalization of the nation state as it emerges through history. And to illustrate her point, she showed a map of South Asia, which has been around for a few years. It's a playful and a conceptually rich map created by Himmel, a South Asian political magazine, which provides an upside-down perspective of South Asia, or what they call a right-side-up perspective, alluding to the ease with which the metaphorical body of Mother India had for years been literalized upon the map of India to enable a symbolic transition of the nation into woman. Professor Menon said that while the Mother India of the Hindu right can easily be transposed onto the map of India that we are familiar with, if we turn the map the other way around, which is still an accurate depiction of the region, suddenly you see the nation as not a natural, unchanging object, but something constantly constructed by various ideologies. The conference, and her lecture in particular, were accused of being anti-national, and members of the Hindu right staged a protest, resulting in a shutdown of the university, and the registrar of the university subsequently filed a police complaint against her and the organizer of the event. Now, it's unclear whether the police will actually act on the complaint, but this event was probably the crowning glory of a year in which the absurdist theater of sedition has been at the center stage of politics in India, where activists, writers, artists, students, and academics have been charged with being anti-national and found guilty of sedition. Now, sedition, amongst other things in India, refers to an act that excites the disaffection for the government and incorporates in a way a logic of affect that creates a legal definition for affects of wounded attachments to the nation. It's strangely befitting that the year of sedition would culminate in outrage provoked over the depiction of an upside-down map. What, after all, are maps if not the greatest symbol of that obscure object of desire, the nation? And the passionate attachments and the maps that maps are able to mobilize can also become wounded attachments, which require penal punishment to restore the pride and dignity of the nation, just like a jilted lover does. David Ludden has argued that even as maps are visual artifacts, they are marked by the presence of invisible elements, and emotions are the most potent of these invisible elements. He uses the phrase cartographic passions to describe the sentiments that underlie maps, a phrase that I find particularly useful in the way that it invites us to think about the affective labors required to actually put maps into work. For Ludden, maps naturalize and universalize the form of the nation state, even as they invisibilize the labors that go into the maintenance of the fiction of maps. It's not surprising, therefore, that in many countries, the monopoly over the production of maps remains with the state. But this monopoly has never prevented people from making their own maps, whether of local roots or of alternative imaginaries that exceed the rigid lines of national boundaries. Wandering sadhus and holy men, for example, who have traversed a sacred geography across South Asia for centuries, reject international borders as political lines, and they claim that they're political lines, not religious ones, suggesting that man-made frontiers falsely carve up the unity of sacred terrain. And as a challenge to the stranglehold that maps have upon territories, Himmel created their right-side-up map of South Asia. And in their description of the map, the editors of Himmel argued that this map of South Asia may seem upside down to some, but that's because we are programmed to think of the North as the top of a page. This rotation is an attempt to reconceptualize regionalism in a way that the focus is on the people rather than the nation states. And this requires nothing less than turning our minds downside up. The incident in February was certainly not the first time that the map had upset people's sentiments. It had earlier been rejected by the Delhi Book Fair for provoking anti-Indian sentiments by placing Sri Lanka at the top. Now, reversing Alfred Korzybski's dictum that the map is not the territory, it appears that the success of maps and nations have been coterminous, and the question of cartographic passions continue to dominate contemporary headlines, filled by anxieties and fears of cartographic contamination. If we've so far focused on spatial maps, let me turn to time, its handmaiden, to see what contiguous fantasies they stage of maps and boundaries. The Asian Relations Conference on 23rd March 1947 was perhaps the first major international conference organized in a colonial state that brought together leaders and delegates of various nationalist movements in Asia who were either waging wars of independence or on the cusp of post-colonial freedom. They came together to discuss the collective future of Asia. And the intention and sentiment of the conference is perhaps best captured in the words of its architect, Jawaharlal Nehru, who in his opening address declared, "We stand at the end of an era and on the threshold of a new period of history. Standing on this watershed which divides two epochs of human history and endeavor, we can look back on our long past and look forward to the future that is taking place before our eyes." For anyone familiar with modern Indian history, it's impossible not to notice the echoes and similarities with his more famous speech that he would give to the Constituent Assembly of India on the eve of Indian independence a few months later at midnight on 14th August 1947. And in that speech, Nehru said, "A moment comes which comes but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends and when the soul of a nation long suppressed finds utterance." Now, in both speeches, we find a clear temporal thrust, moving between the oppressive past and an optimistic, even if uncertain, future. But the main difference between the two is that while the former was addressed to the imagination of the possibilities of a collective Asia, the latter is clearly addressed to a national imagination. It's also crucial to remember, of course, that the second speech was given even as the subcontinent was reeling under the violence of the partition of India and Pakistan, which resulted in the death of close to 500,000 people and the displacement of 15 million people between the two nations. The Asian Relations Conference, on the other hand, happened just before Lord Mountbatten came as the last Viceroy of India to oversee the partition. And no one at that time could have imagined the brutality that would be unleashed a few months later. In light of the consolidation of the nation state that would take place in the subcontinent, as well as in most parts of Southeast Asia, Nehru's opening address in the Asian Relations Conference appears almost anachronistic. And if the fact that the date today seems uncanny, then the entire event seems a little untimely in retrospect. The philosophical idea of the untimely, of course, comes to us via Nietzsche, who sought to develop a philosophy of time that was dynamic and did not subsume time to the past or to history alone. And for Nietzsche, we needed a theory of history or a form of reading the past, not just in light of the present, but for the future. In relation to events of the past, such as the Asian Relations Conference, then there are two ways of revisiting them. One is to follow them in the course of history as they become, in a way, a part of the idea of a historical event. But the second is to go back into the event and to take one's place in it as a becoming, or to grow both young and old in it at the same time, in Deleuze's famous words. And it's with this sentiment that I believe there's a merit in revisiting the Asian Relations Conference for its contemporary and future relevance. But before examining the debates that took place in that 1 week in March 1947, it's worth contextualizing the event in the backdrop of an internationalism that was a necessary part of many anti-colonial struggles, in which the nation was not an always already constituted end of the anti-colonial struggle. Many scholars have rightly identified the interwar years as a crucial period for the rise of international solidarity against imperialism. And there were many events such as the Universal Races Conference in London in 1911, the Baku Conference of Peoples of the East 1920, and all of them serve as important milestones. But the most important one of that was perhaps the 1927 Brussels Conference, initiated by Berlin-based Willy Munzeberg and his organization Workers' International Relief. Munzenberg brought together some of the most important leaders and thinkers from around the world, including Nehru, the Nobel Prize winners Einstein and Romain Rolland, and Mesdi El Hadj of the Algerian North African Star, and Madame Sun Yat-sen. Imagined as a direct response against the League of Nations and its perpetuation of colonialism, it resulted in the formation of the League Against Imperialism. Nehru became an important part of the executive committee of the League. And Berlin was at the heart, at that point of time, of various socialist and imperial anti-imperialist groups working during the period. But ironically, the Congress itself took place in Brussels because the Belgian government offered a meeting place in Weeze for participants in exchange for a promise that Belgian imperialism would not be discussed and critiqued. The organizers accepted the terms because the French, the German, and the British governments had refused to provide accommodation for the event or to provide passport endorsements for travels. Michel Leroux proposes that the Brussels Congress forced Nehru to rethink anti-imperial struggles beyond the realm of the nation. And Leroux points out that Nehru interestingly drew upon Mahatma Gandhi's words to articulate a synthesis of Indian nationalism and a nascent, of Indian nationalism and a nascent internationalism. Nehru said during the Congress, "The Indian National Congress is necessarily national and has nationalism at its basis. But as our great leader Gandhi has said, our nationalism is based on the most intense internationalism. The problem of Indian freedom is for us vital and urgently essential, but at the same time, it is not merely a purely national problem." Writing to Gandhi, Nehru from Brussels says, "I do not think it's desirable, nor indeed is it possible for India to plow a lonely furrow now or in the future." And he goes on to add, "I'm afraid that we are terribly narrow in our outlook, and the sooner we get rid of the narrowness, the better. Our salvation can, of course, come from the internal strength that we may have evolved, but one of the methods of evolving such strength should be the study of our other people and their ideas." And this was an overarching theme of the Congress. George Lansbury, in his address, urged members not to be fooled by the cry of mere nationalism. And all of this had a clearly important impact on Nehru, who in his letters back started warning about the dangers of narrow-minded nationalism. The international solidarity of communists against imperialism during the interwar years greatly troubled the British authorities, an anxiety that peaked in 1931 with a massive conspiracy case in a small town called Meerut against communists for sedition and conspiracy to wage war against the emperor. In a trial that lasted for 4 years, from 1929 to 1933, and it was the most expensive trial ever conducted by the British Empire, there was an interesting strategy that was pursued by the prosecutors in the case to make a clear distinction between the good nationalists and the bad internationalists, or the communists. In his opening speech at Meerut during the prosecution, the chief prosecutor, Langford James, tried to prove that communists in the dock were totally different from the good nationalist politicians. And he said, "The communists do not belong to this country. Their cause is not the nationalist cause. It appears to me that to be a Bolshevik of unimpeachable character, you require certain definite qualifications. You do not love your country. You are anti-country, you are anti-God, and you are anti-family. You have to ruthlessly hate those who differ from you. And in fact, last but not least, I think it is quite essential that you should have no sense of humor." One can imagine a slightly macabre version of this playing out in the next few weeks, where Muslims will be accused of being anti-country, anti-everything, and last but not least, you have no laptop or iPad. So everyone was very surprised during the Meerut trial about why Nehru was not one of the accused in the trial, since it was widely anticipated that he would be charged. He subsequently became part of the Legal Defense Committee to defend the accused in the Meerut conspiracy case. And it's against this backdrop of internationalism that we need to understand and locate Nehru's specific advocacy of the Asian Relations Conference. Organized by the Indian Council for World Affairs under the chairmanship of Nehru, the event was designed to be a public event, and the choice of the venue, the Purana Qila, or the Old Fort, was taken specially to accommodate crowds of over 10,000 people who bought tickets to attend the event. There were 5 topics that were chosen to be discussed, but the 2 which I think are crucial for our interests is the question of the national movements for freedom, and the second one, which is the migration and racial problems. The opening remarks by all the delegates echo each other in their earnestness as well as in their high rhetoric of Asian civilization that all of them invoked. References were made to the antiquity of Asian civilization and cultures, the common and similar suffering under colonialism, and the moment of change that was underway and the need to reimagine how Asian states would relate to each other outside of any mediation by the West. Sarojini Naidu, who was known as the Nightingale of India, in her unofficial capacity as the Poet Laureate of India, made one of the opening addresses and spoke in flowery and metaphorical terms, and I quote, "We have been buried for centuries. We had forgotten the splendors of our past, the teachings of ancestors and poets, and we believed that we were dead. But when the springtime calls to us, the heart throbs. Is there any man so dead, so deeply buried in the tomb that his heart does not beat to the call of birds of springtime? Who will bid us and say, halt, and thus no farther? The birds have cried, have said, why do you cry for the moon? No, we do not cry for the moon. We pluck it from the skies and wear it upon the diadem of Asia's freedom." The replies from all the other delegates, I can assure you, were also equally kind of flowery. Not surprisingly, Nehru's address was one of the most noteworthy, and it's to some of the issues that he identifies that I want to turn to. Nehru begins by reminding the delegates that one of the most notable consequences of European colonialism was the isolation of countries in Asia from each other, an isolation that he felt was finally disappearing, and that the event and the conference was an expression of a deeper urge of the mind and spirit of which Asia has persisted. And he says, "The old land routes have almost ceased to function, and our chief window to the outer world looked out on the sea routes which led to England. The old imperialisms are fading away. The land routes have been revived, and the air suddenly brings us very near to each other." He proceeded to say that the conference was being organized on equal terms and that there were neither leaders nor followers amongst the countries. And he said, "We seek no narrow nationalism. Nationalism has a place in each country and should be fostered, but it must not be allowed to become aggressive and come in the way of international development. Strong winds are blowing all over Asia. Let's not be afraid of them, but rather welcome them, for only with their help can we build the new Asia of our dreams." While one cannot help but admire Nehru's optimism and the larger spirit that he hoped would inform the discussion in the conference, every single point of optimism that he raised was already a source of tension in the conference, where the aspiration for a pan-Asianism would begin to unravel even before it started. And let me look at two of them. The first one was the question of Indian and Chinese hegemony. So despite Nehru's assertion that there were no leaders and followers in Asia, there were very serious concerns expressed by all the delegates about the size of the two largest countries, India and China. There was a sentiment that kept getting articulated through the conference by a number of the smaller countries expressing their concerns about the future of Asia. A delegate from Sri Lanka argued that they might be faced with aggression, not necessarily political, but economic and demographic, by their big brothers, India and China. One issue which was particularly thorny and which kept coming up over and over again was the role of Indian soldiers in the suppression of various national self-determination movements in different parts of Asia. A Burmese delegate accused India of being a tool in the hands of British imperialism for subjugating countries around India, adding that while Burma needed the assistance of her neighbors for rebuilding her ruined economy, in getting this assistance, they didn't want European capitalism and exploitation to be replaced by brown exploitation. The delegate from India assured all the other Asians that this was only a part of the colonial past and that India stood strongly behind the ongoing freedom struggles in Vietnam and Indonesia. But despite these professed solidarities, it was clear that when it came to actual support, countries did not feel that these sentiments necessarily translated into actual solidarity. The Vietnamese delegation complained that the arms and ammunitions that were being manufactured in India were being used in their liberation struggle. And he believed that if there was adequate support, it had to be more than just a symbolic one. Nehru replied that he did not see any other mode of acting because what was expected of them was to declare war against France, and that was not possible. This was a sentiment that was supported and echoed by China. And one thing which is interesting for us to think about, and it's difficult to answer, is would the Nehru of the Brussels Conference and the Brussels Congress and the League Against Imperialism have reacted differently to this demand for support? Here was a Nehru who was already the leader of a provincial government with an awareness that he would be prime minister in a few months. In other words, could the imperative towards diplomacy that he displays during the Asian Relations Conference be read as the completion of an integration not just into the nation system, state system, but also off the nation state system? Second big question that arose, and this is the one that's crucial for us, was the question of nationality and citizenship. Now, Nehru identified land routes and trade routes as the unifying thread across Asia before the colonial encounter. And this he sharply contrasted with the use of sea routes during the colonial period as somehow being a false mode of travel brought about by the exigencies of colonial trade and labor. And he moves from there to the present and the possibilities opened out by air travel, which would bring people much closer together. What's interesting for me is this bracketing of the third mode of transport, namely sea routes, since this becomes the source of the precise tension in the Asian Relations Conference and significantly shapes debates on nationalism and citizenship to follow. If the land routes hark back to a pre-colonial period, which is not really in the living memory of Asians, and if the air routes implied only a travel between the elites or of government officials and hence too distant from the lives of ordinary people, the most recent form of inter-Asian travel was indeed through ships that facilitated the movement of labor across the empire, and precisely the most recent one as well, and the most contentious one for all the nations to come. The largest movement of people across the British Empire had only been partially of a voluntary nature, and while it's true that there had been movements across land, it's with the demand for indentured labor in the mid-19th century that a large number of people, landless laborers from Bihar, Tamil Nadu, had been transported to nearby as well as distant colonies to work on plantations owned by the British. From tea plantations in Sri Lanka to the rubber plantations and the infamous death railway lines in Malaysia and in Burma, in which almost 60,000 Tamilian laborers had died, it was Indian labor that had accounted for a majority of the workforce. Generations of Indians had worked in these countries, often moving back and forth between India and these other countries, raising their families and extending them through kinship networks, a sense of community that had actually begun to generate. And this is a story that's also similarly true for the Chinese in Malaysia. The free passage across the colonies was, in fact, one of the promised political freedoms of empire, even if it played out in racially differentiated ways, as evidenced by the infamous Komagata Maru incident of 1914, in which over 300 Indians were refused entry into Canada for racial reasons despite being British subjects. Sunil Amrit, a historian, in his fantastic history of the Bay of Bengal, says that between 1840 and 1940, at least 28 million people crossed the Bay of Bengal in both directions. And the region was home to one of the world's largest migrations and one of the least known. He argues that the movement of people across these fluid imperial boundaries were first interrupted by war, and then subsequently, with the coming of post-colonial sovereignty, the fluidity of the Bay of Bengal gave way to the fixed borders of the nation-state. And the bay, which stretched as waterways, was soon carved up by the boundaries of nation-states, creating for the first time clearly demarcated zones such as South Asia and Southeast Asia. In the Asian Relations Conference, the discussion in the session on migration was dominated by the question of national belonging and what the status of these migrant populations would be in the aftermath of independence. The urgency of these questions was accentuated by the fact that race relations between host population and migrants had been under serious stress in the years leading up to 1947, with numerous race riots targeting migrant Chinese or Indian workers. So thus, even as the countries assembled together to discuss their collective futures, their discussion was staged under the shadows of a clearly defined distinction between those who belonged and those who didn't. A Malaysian delegate in the session on racial problems argued that Chinese in Malaysia cannot have their bodies there and their minds here, or their minds here and their bodies there. And a recurrent fear was articulated by the smaller countries was of being swamped by these large migrant populations. A delegate from Burma said that whatever migrant communities choose will create a problem. If a large number of migrants chose local nationality, then such actions would go against the indigenous races. If, on the other hand, they chose not to do so, then it would be unfair, after generations of living there, to suggest that the migrants should be called back to their mother country. But if there was rising concern about the status of migrants in their adopted country, then the two largest feeding countries, India and China, were unified in their stand that migrant populations who had crossed over to other nations were citizens of that nation and not of the originating nation. According to Itti Abraham, the triumph of the logic of territorial nation states in this period and during the conference resulted in the creation of two kinds of numerical hierarchies, between majority and minority, which replicated racial divisions, and between its internal citizens on the basis of the civilized modern versus its primitive other, namely indigenous populations. The newly unmarked national center, according to Abraham, would produce two corresponding margins: the ethnic minority who were too new to be politically entitled, and the indigenous people who were too old to be politically entitled. Thus, while the rhetoric of the opening remarks by the host, as well as the representatives of the participating countries, were filled with a self-congratulatory sentiment of a shared civilizational heritage and a shared suffering under colonialism, the real sites of this shared terrain were quickly abandoned in favor of a more traditional nation-state form, which went back to the more classical understanding of freedom from colonial domination being the establishment of a republic as well as an entry into the international kind of League of Nations. And after independence, both Burma and Sri Lanka passed citizenship laws that were based on race and ethnicity, differentiating between citizens by descent and those by registration. Much of the violence of South Asia as well as Southeast Asia in the post-colonial period have been a continuation of the unresolved tensions of this period, the most significant one being the race riots targeting Tamilians in Sri Lanka, culminating in the pogrom of 1985, which finally resulted in the formation of the self-determination movement of the Tamilians and the 25-year-old civil war in Sri Lanka. For David Ludden, the critical tension was that of the privileging by anti-colonial movements in the moment of their victory of the form of the territorial state rather than the historical fact of territories produced by mobility. And as a result, he says, we imagine that mobility is border crossing. As though borders came first and mobility second, the truth is the other way around. So how do we evaluate the Asian Relations Conference and in what manner may be revisited? I began with the idea that one way of inhabiting it is in an untimely fashion, as it grows young and as it grows old at the same time. And towards this end, I find it very fruitful to think with Svetlana Boyne's idea of a reflective nostalgia. In her book, The Future of Nostalgia, Boyne distinguishes between a restorative nostalgia, which she sees as a conservative project aimed at the melancholic resurrection of fallen empires, and a reflective nostalgia that looks to the past and its unrealized dreams and visions, which were rendered obsolete to project into a future. A move that she terms as the future past of nostalgia. And the imperative for the contemporary nostalgic for her is therefore to be homesick and to be sick of home at the same time. In revisiting the conference, we must be cautious of the monumental regionalism that underlies it, since one could argue that this was a project that was going to be underwritten by the nation-state form in any case. And yet at the same time, how much time do I have? Oh, okay. Towards the end of an incredible moment of the anti-colonial struggle, and even before many of the countries had actually become full-fledged nation states, the commitment to an ideal beyond narrow nationalism is something that one cannot but be a little nostalgic for in the contemporary era of ugly ultranationalism. If the migrant was at the center of the debate then, it's at the center of contemporary debates now, and I know tomorrow we'll be visiting this a lot more. And as Thomas Nail says, the 21st century will be the century of the migrant. Nail identifies the idea of migration as not one of a movement of a people from a static A to a static B, but he says that if we think instead of a kinopolitics or a politics of movement, in which the force of movement rather than stasis becomes the default, such that movement reconstitutes not just people and their legal or political status, but territory as well, then territory is recomposed through such movements. And Nail says, it's not surprising that water metaphors, such as flows, flux, floods, saturate the political language of migrants. And if we return to the Asian Relations Conference and ask what the consequence would have been if they had truly pulled back into their own history of continuous movement, like a javelin thrower to project into the future, a lot of the focus of recent scholarship around Asian history has attempted to move away from the regional and the national frame by turning to oceanic studies, the Indian Ocean studies, Bay of Bengal studies, a lot of them influenced, of course, by Fernand Braudel's advocacy of the idea of foregrounding people across a mass of water at its center rather than the lands around its peripheries. And if I started this talk today with a distorted map, it might be appropriate to end with a similarly distorted map. In his History of the Bay of Bengal, Sunil Amrit, in a lamenting tone, says, one by one, the lands that border the Bay of Bengal gained independence from colonial rule between 1947 and 1957. They renegotiated their relations with each other. They jostled for a position in the world divided by the new tensions of the Cold War. The Bay of Bengal that had cohered over centuries, a world of competing empires and overlapping diasporas, gave way to a sea of nations. What then might it be to return our historic and geographic imagination, not to the sea as the space between nations, but as congruous to and constitutive of maps that people produce? Consider, for example, this map that Amrit uses. For people familiar with the map of India, this is not a distorted map, and yet it appears unfamiliar to us, accustomed to seeing from the perspective of land. The landmass and borders of the nations in this map appear only as the edges of the ocean. In the case of India's troubled periphery, such as the Northeast, from a land-based perspective, it's a troubled zone which acts as a buffer between India and China, but it equally could be a gateway to China and Southeast Asia. Thankfully, outside of the ambitious conferences, people have continued to stretch the boundaries and imagination of maps. And a good example of this is an artwork by the Bombay-based group CAMP called The Country of the Sea, which looks at ships and sailors who move between the western coast of India via the various ports of the Arab coastline, Gulf, and finally to East Africa. This map invites us and insists on thinking of the world of the seafarers who are configured as residents, not of land, but of the sea between the shores of East Africa, West Asia, and Western India. And this is perhaps where the themes and the interests of this conference for the next 3 days converges. As cartographic passions take on increasingly more virulent tones, inviting the violence of law and the state to crush our fabulous geographies, the urgent need of our times are political and aesthetic practices that distort maps and promote disorderly mobilities. To conclude with the words of George Steiner, trees have roots, humans have legs with which to visit, to dwell amongst the rest of mankind as guests. And I want to think of these visitors as the truly human beings we must try to become if we are to survive at all. Thank you.